This week, we talk about the magic in ritual. Is it truly magic, or is it a psychological change that drastically rearranges the way man thinks about life? We've got a great piece from Brother Akram R. Elias, past Grand Master, on the magic of ritual. Then, we'll hear the tale of William Dodd, a Freemason who got into some trouble, forged a signature in order to pay back some debts, and got caught up in a wild tale that you're not going to want to miss in an all-new Masonic Minute from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. We'll then wrap it up with a segment from Brother Matt Gallagher in Practical Freemasonry when we talk about a lodge's retention point. This isn't some magical number that talks about how well your lodge is doing. In fact, it's the point in a man's journey in Freemasonry that he decides it's for him and he's in for life. So where is that point in the Masonic journey? As we'll see, it's not necessarily the third degree. All this and more, stay tuned in this episode of Whence Came You.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 516. In the news, not a whole lot going on. Likely just got back from the Grand Lodge Sessions of Illinois, or the annual communication, as it is known. I'm assuming everything went okay. I am recording this before I leave, so hopefully everything is awesome. I hope I had a great time. I hope you all had a great time. I want to thank very much Austin Lodge for having me out. It was a fantastic event, this Oktoberfest. So many brothers, so many guys. I mean, I scanned the audience, and I just saw all these guys, these brothers that I knew, the movers and shakers of Freemasonry, at least in Texas. It was awesome to see Brother Robert Marshall, Brother Craig Hammonds, the Master of the Lodge, Byron Webster, of course, Brother James Medlock, Ronnie Zulu, like all these guys. It was crazy cool. I was a little starstruck at meeting a lot of these guys. But I just have to say thanks so much to Austin Lodge for having me out. A special shout out to Brother Jim. You know who you are, man, if you ever listen to this. I love you, and thanks so much for everything. Let's get to the first educational piece for this week. And before we get into it and reading it, as I usually do, I'm going through science news and all of these things. And one of the articles I recently came across was an article that talked about biblical era Israeli shrine shows signs of the earliest ritual use of marijuana. Now, recently I read an article, having trouble figuring out, remembering which publication it was, but there was an article relating to the use of some of the entheogenic stuff when it comes to ritual. In particular, somebody had mentioned how absurd it was to think that the burning bush was marijuana and all of these things. So there was all of this pointing out of the conjecture and drawing conclusions that comes from this. So what was interesting, however, was that they did this chemical analysis in this article. Is the chemical analysis of residue from an altar reveals a cannabis animal dung mixture. So pretty interesting to note that these substances were used in ritual, and perhaps not in the way some folks have assumed or written about of any kind of authoritative writing, experts or anything. Now, these are a lot of times are people who research this stuff on the side, armchair researchers and whatnot, and then they write articles and books, and so it's really cool. One book that I do have to say is really good on the topic and makes some great points of interest is Brother P.D. Newman's book, Alchemically Stoned. And if you wanted to take it a little bit further and step out on that edge just a little bit more, you can check out his next book, which is Angels in Vermilion, and that is available out there also already. And I think we actually interviewed Brother P.D. Newman on that book not too long ago. I'll have a link to that episode in the show notes if you wanted to go back and check it out. It was a special one we did where we actually had video along with it. So this idea of mind-altering substances for ritual I thought was kind of interesting, but really speaks to the importance of the ritual itself. There's this idea that the ritual should be engaging and life-changing for you, something memorable to happen. And certainly the use of these kinds of substances may have been used to do just that. I mean, we know about the Greek Kaikian and other drinks such as this that perhaps had mind-altering effects. Now, while thinking about this, another article that came up when I was researching more oddities as it went with ritual is this article I found that there's evidence that 6,000 years ago, trepanning, or cutting a hole in one's skull, was a ritual use and had some sort of reason that they would do this ritually. The skulls that they analyzed shows that bone regrowth happened, which means everybody survived these really weird ritual surgeries. They've recovered over 16 skulls. At the end of the article, it says rituals and meanings attached to ancient trepanations in southern Russia will remain mysterious. We don't know the myths and religions of tribes that lived there 6,000 years ago. So we just know that they did it. We don't know why. So some interesting things that happen with ritual, this magic, if you will, that happens when we do something really serious to affect you on a psychological level that changes you forever. Let that be the foundation as we read this first piece called The Magic of Masonic Ritual. And it's by Brother Akram R. Elias, who's a past Grand Master, of course, and who means a great deal to myself and a lot of other brothers. You can catch an episode we did with him about the Masonic Legacy Society if you head over to MLS2026.com. The Magic of Masonic Ritual by Brother Akram R. Elias. In today's fast-paced world and culture of searching for more and more comfort in life, does Freemasonry need to have rituals, and should it do away with them? And if Freemasonry chose to keep its rituals, should those be simply read, or should they be learned? This short article is an attempt to make the case for the continuous use of rituals and the necessity of having them learned rather than read. 1. Institutional continuity. Quote, "Men make history, but institutions ensure its continuity." Napoleon Bonaparte. Throughout human history, institutions have been established to ensure the continuity of a founding idea, belief, or philosophy. From ancient mythologies to monotheism, religious institutions were founded to perpetuate a specific belief relating to the origins of life on earth and the meaning of life and death. When Moses introduced the belief that Jehovah is the one omnipotent God, creator of the universe, Judaism was born as an institutionalized religion to ensure the continuity of that belief. When Jesus preached his gospel, Christianity came to be preserved and spread that message. The same applies to Muhammad and Islam. Establishing institutions to ensure continuity is not limited to the purely religious sphere, however. Schools of thought, political movements, military institutions, and even systems of government, from monarchies to democracies, have all come to existence in order to ensure that continuity of which they were founded upon. Having established that continuity is the primordial objective of all religious and secular institutions. Let us explore the connection, if any, between continuity and ritual. Can a religion, mythological or monotheistic, school of thought, philosophical or scientific, school of conduct, civic or military, or system of government, monarchical or democratic, continue to exist over time without rituals? For example, can Catholicism continue as an institution without the ritual of Mass and Communion? Can the Boy Scouts of America continue to exist without its ritual of initiation and moral conduct? Can American patriotism continue without the ritual of the Pledge of Allegiance? And finally, can democracy continue to exist without rituals such as the vote? One may argue in the affirmative, but historical and sociological evidence points out that successful institutions over time have considered ritual as key to meeting that objective of continuity. So what is ritual? Anthropologists Leach and Turner defined ritual as, quote-unquote, endless repetitions that convey meaning in a different, less simple way than other statements, and, quote-unquote, convey meaning by means of symbols. But why do institutions eager to ensure their continuity rely heavily on rituals? Plato believed that rituals state through symbolism that this world is a shadow of another, while modern anthropologists see ritual as creating through symbolism an image of a shadow out of the reality of this world. although a shadow which is presented as the real thing. Whether we agree with Plato or the anthropologist is not the point, for in either case, rituals are used to reinforce, through symbolism, a belief in a reality or perceived reality. They embody institutional memories and promote a cohesiveness of purpose in conduct and behavior. That is why they are conceived as relatively fixed sequences of behavior and as a result are not individual and not ad hoc, according to a professor of the School of London Economics and Political Science. Although long-standing institutions change their rituals over time, they never let go of them, for if they did, they would soon go down the road of extinction. Ritual preserves institutional memory and reinforces cohesiveness and a sense of common purpose among members of the same institution. Imagine, for example, what would happen to the powerful Catholic Church if it were to abandon its rituals. Some would argue that ritual is at the core of why the Catholic Church has been so successful in preserving its continuity when compared to other Christian denominations. Do you think that Judaism would have persisted over the ages in face of persecution and anti-Semitism if Jews had abandoned their rituals? Freemasonry is no different. Though neither a religion nor a government, Freemasonry is an institution that relies heavily on ritual to preserve its continuity as a universal fraternity. The day Freemasonry starts neglecting its rituals, it will be the beginning of its end. 2. Ritual and the candidate. Having established the importance of ritual for the purpose of continuity, we need to address whether the Masonic ritual should be read or learned. In Masonry, ritual is always present, whether for the purpose of conducting lodge business or the conferral of degrees. Let us first focus on the conferral of degrees. No matter what the degree in question is, the candidate for that degree undergoes a powerful moral drama. The more powerful the impression on the candidate, the more impact it will have on his conscience. When ritual is read during a degree conferral, the drama is weakened to the point that it becomes an intellectual exercise at best. When recited, however, it becomes a sequence of acts in a living drama, with a candidate being its primary witness. The impact there is tremendous. Can you imagine yourself attending a Shakespeare's theatrical performance where the actors would read their lines instead of acting them through recital? How disappointed would you be? A candidate to a Masonic degree would feel the same disappointment if he were deprived the aura and mysticism of that powerful drama embedded in that degree. I cannot describe to you in words the feelings I had every time I received a degree at Potomac Lodge No. 5, my mother lodge in the District of Columbia. I truly felt that I was going through something very special and unique. No reading could ever convey the power of those degrees and cause such emotional reaction. 3. Ritual and the Mason, True Alchemy. Quote, could we know what men are most apt to remember, we might know what they are most apt to do. End quote. Halifax. Having addressed the powerful impact that recited ritual has on the candidate for Masonic degrees, we need now to focus on the more complex question of the importance of learned ritual to the individual brother Mason. In other words, why should a Mason learn his ritual rather than simply read it? What difference does it make? The answer to this question is in two parts. First, the officers of a lodge would have to learn the ritual in order to put together the necessary degree work for candidates in the manner we discussed earlier. But since going through the chairs is conceived as a process of maturity for the individual Mason in search of light, then each and every brother would need at some time to be proficient in the ritual. But even if a Mason chooses not to seek the East in lodge, his search for further light would greatly benefit from learning the ritual. Let me explain. We know that rituals, through symbolism, make lasting impression upon a man's consciousness. What does this really mean? Tim Shallis, MRC Applied Psychology, Unit at Cambridge, shed some light on the importance of consciousness. Quote, a variety of empirical phenomena, such as the blind sight syndrome, indicate that if there is to be a scientific understanding of human thought, consciousness cannot be dismissed as mere epiphenomenon. On the contrary, it relates to some very central aspect of the human information processing system. End quote. In other words, consciousness plays a paramount role in influencing physical behavior, and if one were to alter his own consciousness, he could ultimately alter his behavior. Harry M. Johnson of the University of Illinois says the following on the meaning of symbol. properly speaking, a symbol stands for a concept, general or particular. The person, thing, category, idea, or event evoked as a concept may be only imaginary, but may, along with other symbolized meanings in complex messages, bring about thoughts, feelings, or intentions in the decoders of the symbol. Indeed, symbolism works very well on intuition by triggering feelings which in turn allow the individual to comprehend at a glance. Pascal put it best when he said, quote, "Those who are accustomed to reason from first principles do not understand matters of feeling at all, because they look for first principles and are unable to comprehend at a glance." End quote. In other words, a man through ritual can affect his consciousness by letting symbols affect his senses and activate his intuition, and an altered state of consciousness ultimately expresses itself in tangible actions. In Freemasonry, that is exactly the purpose of ritual. As Masons, we believe that Freemasonry takes good men and makes them better. Indeed, it is through its rich moral rituals that Freemasonry makes such a deep and lasting impact on the individual brother. By altering one's own level of consciousness, a good man can make himself better through a gradual process of internal change. This is true alchemy, and therefore the most important aspect of Masonic ritual. This was published July 1st, 2009. What I love here is this gets to the heart of the idea of Masonic ritual as a thing that is esoteric but explained in a scientific way that still keeps it esoteric, psychological, if you will. A very profound idea, and it's something that I think a lot of guys understand but have trouble putting into words. And I think this was a great way to put this in words. It is truly magic of Masonic ritual. We are performing something that is changing the way you think forever when properly done. I know most men who have gone through the degrees will say something like, "I'll never be the same," and it's true. Next up, let's hear from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison in this week's Masonic Minute.
Born in Lincolnshire in 1729, William Dodd was a vicar's son who became an honors student at the University of Cambridge. He was a man of letters, authoring over 50 books and pamphlets. He subsequently became a doctor of divinity and served as chaplain to King George II, as well as a minister to Magdalene Hospital. Dodd was initiated into the mysteries of Freemasonry April 3, 1775, and a month later, he became England's first Grand Chaplain. As an accomplished author and eloquent orator, Brother Dodd became very popular with the people of England and was well connected with the most important people of his time. He enjoyed moving in the circles of the rich and famous and began to favor the trappings of wealth and society. Piling on the excesses and luxuries of the life of a member of the British nobility finally became too much for his finances. Dodd incurred heavy debt and exacerbated the situation by trying to gamble his way out of it. His gambling losses simply made things worse. In 1774, he attempted to bribe his way into a high-paying position, but his scheme was discovered, and he was fired from all of his existing positions. A few months later, when he joined the Masons, it may just have been an attempt to once again become well-connected and begin his journey back up the social ladder. In need of funds, Dodd forged a bond from the Earl of Chesterfield, then borrowed against it to settle his finances. The plan might have worked, but the banker involved saw a blot on the bond document which obscured some of the text. He rewrote the document, and when he took it to the Earl for signature, Dodd's plan was discovered. Dodd confessed to the crime. Since the banker had acted so quickly, Dodd had spent very little of the money, which enabled him to make full restitution. Brother Dodd went to trial and based his defense on the fact that this had been an act of indiscretion and that the crime was mitigated by the fact he returned all the money. The jury did not see it that way. Its members convicted him of forgery, which at the time was punishable by death. Even so, the jurors recommended clemency for the popular preacher. Notwithstanding, the judge sentenced Dodd to be hanged. Dodd was so popular, 23,000 people petitioned the king for a pardon, but to no avail. On June 27, 1777, the day of his execution, the 48-year-old Dodd rode in a black mourning coach with his father. On the way to the gallows, the coach stopped, as dictated by tradition, at a pub, where Dodd was given a beer. This practice is said by some to be the origin of the term, one for the road. The guards along with him also received a beer, but the driver of the coach could not partake, because he was said to be on the wagon. Another tradition of the time was that stewards at the gallows would take up a collection from the bloodthirsty crowd in attendance. If they collected enough money, the condemned man would be given a short drop in order that he would succumb more slowly and give the spectators a longer, more graphic performance. In spite of his popularity, the crowd antied up enough for the gruesome show. As Dodd dropped from the scaffold, however, the Lord High Executioner ran down the steps, grabbed Dodd by the legs, and pulled him downward to prevent flailing and to speed things along. In a bit of irony, Dodd had always been a death penalty opponent. Just earlier that year, he had given an inspiring sermon against it. In addition, he was a big supporter of the Humane Society, which at the time was advocating the possibility of reviving those who had been hung, drowned, or died under similar circumstances, speculating that even though appearing deceased, a bit of life might remain. Even today, the Society's motto is Latiat Scintillula Forsan, meaning, a small spark may perhaps lie hid. The fact is, some executions were sloppy enough at the time that this is known to have worked on rare occasions. So as soon as Dodd was cut down, his friends rushed to claim his body, knowing his neck had not been broken by the short drop. They carried him into the mourning coach and tried to go to the home of Dr. John Hunter to attempt a revival. The crowd reportedly rushed the coach and prevented its exit, either to view the body or stop its transfer. So it is unlikely any attempt at revival occurred. However, for years, rumors persisted that Dodd was revived and went off to live in France. Dodd's brother Richard was rector of Cowley, which is where reports say Dodd's burial took place. Today, no marker exists for his grave, but a wall plaque says he rests within the cemetery. There is no record of his burial there, which has fueled speculation that he may have survived. Shortly after his hanging, England changed the penalty for forgery, and Dodd remains the last person executed for that crime. And while a minute measure of doubt may remain about him surviving the execution, one thing is for certain. Upon hearing of his conviction, the Freemasons immediately expelled the unfortunate William Dodd. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
Wow, how many twists and turns did this take? I mean,
I was waiting for some redemption story, and it just never came. At first, I thought the executioner was going to pull him down and save his life. Then I thought perhaps when that didn't work, the crowd would get him to the doctor, and he would be revived, and that didn't work. Just so many potential spots within the story that could leave room for him to continue living. In fact, I thought when they stopped for the beer, maybe he would have been let go or escaped or something. So I guess, you know, three strikes and he's out. three opportunities within this story for some kind of twist of fate to let him live, and it just didn't happen. Just wild. If you enjoyed this story, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on the bookstore, and check out the books by Stephen L. Harrison. Brother Steve has been working a very long time and diligently for the Missouri Lodge of Research and his own writing projects to bring us stories like this and to preserve history and to tell us the amazing moments in time where Freemasonry plays a part in some extraordinary tale within the history of humanity. Now, Brother Steve also has awesome videos that usually accompany these segments, so if you'd like to check out the videos as well, we publish those on the WCY Podcast YouTube channel. I'd appreciate if anybody out there, if you got a extra second, click the like button, you know, when you check out those videos, or subscribe, turn on your notifications, all of those things to not miss each one of these excellent segments. Our thanks one more time goes out to illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison for all of his work and everything he continues to do for Freemasonry. It is simply astounding. I always say when I grow up, I want to be Steve Harrison. So if you see Steve out on the road, presenting somewhere, or just in lodge, give him a handshake and make sure you tell him thanks for all he does.
What is your retention point? Originally published in the Practicing Freemason monthly newsletter, available through practicalfreemasonry.com, by me, Matt Gallagher. At what point in a membership process does an interested party go from a prospect to an all-in lifetime member? This is outlined in Robert Scrobb's Retention Point, a book detailing a sales concept for membership and subscription services, but is very applicable to a fraternity like Freemasonry, and whose ideas I will outline in a frame suitable for Masons. It seems like lodges and grand lodges alike are always forming membership and retention committees, to varying effect. But in our debates, we miss the most critical ingredient of the Masonic experience, the retention point. This is the special moment which has happened to many of us, at which we knew that not only did we want to be a Mason, but that we were going to be an active Mason, possibly for the rest of our lives. Retention point is best illustrated in TV. In any great television show, there is an episode or scene that finally gets us hooked. In the beginning, the story seems okay, mediocre even, and then that thing happens. Before you know it, you're binge-watching season after season. That's the retention point, the point which, when a viewer reaches it, 70% of them will watch until the show's end. Networks track this retention point, and the goal for creators is to get that retention point as close to the beginning of the series as possible, because, and here's the rub, the viewer must make it to that episode or scene. Before that, they could, and often do, turn it off and never think about it again. Masonic Lodges, being a membership-based subscription service of its kind, functions in this same way, but a brother reaching their retention point isn't nearly as noticeable as the ones who never hit it. Every lodge sees it. We get interested candidates, they take their degrees, and some are never seen again. Others seem to give it an honest try, but then their attention and attendance wanes. A small minority of us, though, just get it, and we're in for life. Some Masons would say our retention point is or should be the third degree. But is it? While the third degree is intended to be a transformative psychodrama of reflection and rebirth, most losses come from brothers who have already gone through it. In truth, Freemasonry in its regular practice doesn't really have an effective retention point. Either a new brother connects with something on an internal level, or he doesn't. While that connection, when made, is strong, its serendipitous nature makes for inconsistent retention. This is the root of Freemasonry's retention problem. We assume the degrees are the hook into Freemasonry, but that's only true if your product is the degrees. But Freemasons aren't selling degrees, we are, quote, selling brotherhood. We frequently hear that if we want to retain brothers, We need quality education, crack ritual, and a good fellowship. And while these are critical requirements in any robust active lodge, are they the things that attract loyal new members? Anyone looking for great ritual would do as well to join a church. Anyone seeking education would do far better in college, or even spending time at their local library. New Masons are looking for a feeling, that ineffable sense of brotherhood and belonging that comes from being among people who love and support you, people who sacrifice for you and require sacrifice from you. Freemasonry is the business of relationship, and relationship trumps all other features of the craft. How do we get a prospective brother to go all in and be a Mason for life? How do we form a clearly defined retention point and present that as early as we can? We do this by forming a robust program of onboarding. There are a million details in Freemasonry, so many that new guys frequently feel lost. The structure of the degrees will get them through the degrees only. Informing your lodge's own unique onboarding process, strip away the detail and focus on the following rules and dialogues as a guide. 1. Inspire the candidate to be a better person. For example, in our lodge, we make each other better people by creating a brotherhood through a dedication to honorable acts, charity and relief, and the search for philosophical truths and brotherly love. 2. Give the candidate a clear path to this brotherhood. For example, every one of our brothers starts this journey by experiencing the degrees, studying, and demonstrating a proficiency in our core rituals and philosophies. From there, we support and assist you on your self-directed journey to perfect yourself. 3. Show them your unique personality. For example, a St. John's brother is different from an Ionic Lodge brother, or an Albert Pike Lodge brother, or a Zarthan Lodge brother. A St. John's brother is a brother who never leaves another to stand alone, never leaves a hand unshook, and never leaves a cocktail half-finished. And 4, relationship is everything. Whenever your prospect seems confused or unsure, refer to these tenets: inspiration, path, personality, and above all, form relationships. Form them with the care and enthusiasm of a scarf-clad village yenta. For each new candidate or class, introduce them to these new expectations. Don't tell them they're new or the candidate is a guinea pig for new ideas. For all they know and should believe, your lodge has been doing this for 100 years. Current and older members will either fall into the new groove or they won't. It's no big deal either way. Insanity is trying to get any person to change their behavior. All anyone can do is offer opportunities for change, and people will take them or they won't. The goal is new brothers carrying new expectations into the future. First, every prospect from the moment they inquire about membership in your lodge should be taken solemnly aside and impressed upon them that membership in your lodge is more than being a Freemason. It comes with rights and responsibilities, that every brother must meet certain expectations. For example, in this lodge we shake hands, look each other in the eye, and always sit together, never apart, and so forth. They can include bigger, more Masonic, relief-oriented things, but the point isn't to be redundant with our official obligations, but to set a standard of social and emotional conduct that set this sacred space apart from the rest of the world, so the candidate understands that they are petitioning to be part of something transformative. Second, every prospect should be told in similar manner what they can expect from your lodge. You will always have someone who will listen. You will never eat or drink alone for want of company. Trust will be given and expected. Benefit of the doubt will be given and expected. Third, if you have been sufficiently convinced that this man would make a good brother, both in our expectations and obligations, and they have already inquired about joining, tell them squarely, "I want you here. I think you are the kind of man who will do these things. You'd benefit our lodge, and our lodge would benefit you." And if there are more specific examples you can cite about how you can help each other, cite them. People want to be part of something bigger than themselves, but more importantly, want to know that they are an important part of that something. Men especially need to feel useful, and it's that feeling we are chiefly offering them. But it can't be a lie. It must be true. This is where Principle 4, Relationship is Everything, comes into play. If you want them to genuinely care about the lodge, they need to see you genuinely care about them. Pay attention, learn his name, use it, be interested. Lastly, don't be repetitive. Nothing stinks like desperation. You told them you wanted them, and you never have to tell them again. Nor should anyone else. You explained how they'd benefit themselves and the lodge by joining, but never give them the impression that you can't do without them. Seeing your lodge as a fully functional brotherhood machine is what makes them want to be a part of it. A new brother's first months in a lodge should be engaging, entertaining, and focused on relationship. After those months, after their degrees, their prove-ups, their congratulatory handshakes, a newly minted mason reaches a critical moment. If his onboarding followed this rough outline, then the retention point should have been reached. He came looking for a vague, wibbly-wobbly concept of brotherhood and meeting, and has hopefully been given not only the feeling that he is in the right place, but a structure of how the lodge functions and his place in that structure. But there's always that drop-off, where the euphoric degree passes, and he's in a lodge, watching openings and closings, listening to debates on mundane businesses, and listening to lectures he won't clearly understand. And even if your lodge meetings are of the highest quality, they will still include debates on mundane business and confusing lectures, because that's a big part of what we're supposed to do. So how do we stop the drop? As stated in Principle 2, every one of our brothers starts this journey by experiencing the degrees, studying and demonstrating a proficiency in our core rituals and philosophies. From there, we assist you in your self-directed journey to perfect yourself. A mason's journey becomes a solitary one at this point. He must choose which way to go. Rites, shrine, officer, sideliner, ritualist, researcher, volunteer, handyman, dishwasher, pancake flipper. There are a lot of choices. It's like picking a major. Take the time to discuss the options with them, and whichever or how many they choose, show them the first steps and introduce them to someone along that path. Because, as repeatedly stated, relationship is everything. Masons are rightly proud of the work we do, the ritual we perform, and the plate of goodies we offer. We lifers hit our retention point early and are binge-watching the fraternity to the end credits. But we're in the minority. Knowing we're selling something to a customer, knowing exactly what we're selling, and focusing on people and relationships can set that retention point firmly and early. By this, we can ensure the faces of the brothers we raise are the faces we see for the rest of our lives. I'm Matt Gallagher for the Wentz Game U Podcast.
All right, my thanks goes out one more time to Brother Matt Gallagher. We have a couple additional segments that we're going to be premiering here on the WCY podcast with Matt, because his new book is just around the corner. So, with that said, I would invite you to check out the links in the show notes to check out more of his work and find out where you can get the new book, Practical Freemasonry. When thinking about this particular issue of a retention point, in the beginning of his essay, I was thinking about, where is that in Freemasonry? Should it be this third degree? But no, because they've been coming for months now. So why are they continuing to come? Is it the promise of a retention point? Is it to see what comes next? Only to be let down by something like discussions on buying single-ply toilet paper or two-ply toilet paper, right? What is that retention point, and where does it lie? Is it that selling point, or is it something else? And then toward the end of his essay, I asked myself, do I remember where my retention point was? What was the point where I thought, I'm all in for life? That's our question this week for the Craftsman Plus. I'd love to hear what you remember as your retention point, that point where you said, I'm hooked on this show forever. I look forward to reading your responses. Our thanks one more time goes out to Brother Matt Gallagher from Practical Freemasonry. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. Again, our thanks goes out to all of our producers, contributors, fellows, and legacy partners for making this show possible every week, every month, every year for over 10 years now. You all have made this program possible. Thank you so much for allowing me to be the one to bring it to you. This is, of course, Masonic education for anybody interested in the royal art. I want to thank illustrious Brother Steve Harrison for his continued efforts, Brother Matt Gallagher for the effort you're putting forth for this fraternity, and all you do as well for graciously giving us some awesome content for the podcast, and of which I'm hearing great feedback. We'll be back next week. I've got some great cool updates to talk about and new segments from Brother Matt Gallagher as well. So until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.